Good morning. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. As many of you, I am interested in protein-DNA interactions. But from the point of view of a biologist, I want to add another layer of complexity, that is, how protein-DNA interaction happen inside the nuclei, in cells, in vivo. I'm going to talk about a special case, c-Myc, but use this as example to illustrate a general approach that we take. And hopefully, this is only a work in progress, and what I'm going to show you is not definitive conclusions, but more a question, more questions raised by what we see. Just as a brief introduction, I'll use these slides to show that one of the central problems in biology is to understand how information is encoded by the genome to direct the development, differentiation, and also to understand how this genome information is evolved through evolution and how human becomes human. The central dogma in biology has been for decades that DNA encodes, DNA information encoded by gene is transcribed into mRNA, which then translated into protein. And each of these steps can be regulated by many different ways. And in fact, each of these individual steps has become a discipline in the biology that are the subject of intense investigation. The step that I'm going to focus on is transcription control, as majority of the human genome is subjected to the regulation at this step. So how is gene transcription regulated? The answer is we don't know. But we know how in general how this would happen. From many years, almost two decades of biochemistry and molecular biology studies, we come to this picture that a gene is usually constructed have upstream enhancer promoter regions and coding regions. The regulation of the control of the transcription of these genes mainly happened controlled by the binding of regulators to the upstream promoter region, which serve to recruit chromatin modification complexes or general transcription machineries and to initiate transcription from that gene. It's being accepted by most people that DNA binding regulators are key to specific gene expression. So in order to figure out how the gene regulation is controlled in a gene-wide scale, we need to find out the interaction, specific interaction between transcription factors and their DNA targets. And that comes back to Gary's talk this morning. What are the codes of protein-DNA interactions? And in this case, what are the codes of DNA protein-DNA interactions in vivo? This is just a view how we think about this problem. Transcription factors, or many factors, are constructed into a network that regulate common sets of genes and distinct sets of genes. And this is a network that so far we can only imagine but haven't have a good clear idea of how this network is constructed. I believe other speakers will talk about this subject more. What I'm going to focus on is, well, just before I start, description of the main approach we take. This is a more practical aspect of why I'm doing the research that we are going on at UCSD. It's mainly because transcription factors, especially this class of transcription factors, have been implicated in human cancers, and the reason is that they are the mutations often happen in this case. In this transcription factors, and they account for majority or more, almost all human cancers that we have known. So understanding their target genes will help us understand pathogenesis of human cancer, and hopefully can help us find diagnostic markers or design normal therapies for the disease. Yes, it's called TP53. Sorry, use a nomenclature that is now more commonly used.
So what fraction of these transcription factors have homologs in, for example, yeast or something?
Depends on how you define homologs, because transcription factors usually their DNA binding domain is pretty conserved, but that's pretty much where the homology is limited to. And if you go beyond that, the homology between different organisms for the same protein is very minimal. So especially between human and yeast, for example, you could not find TP53's homolog in yeast, and vice versa, and a lot of so it's very minimal. It's probably around 30% to 40%, same as other proteins in the genome. Yes?
Yeah, when you say these are cancer-related transcription factors, does it mean when there's a mutation, it causes cancer?
Yes.
How
so there is genetic evidence that this genetic alterations of these genes has been implicated in a particular type of cancer, as I listed here.
So patients with this cancer tend to have mutations.
That's right. That's right. So the main question is, how do we find out where a transcription factor bind in vivo in the genome? There hasn't been, until several years ago, there hasn't been a very good methodology to do this. People mainly rely on in vitro methods like Celex to identify binding site for a transcription factor. But the problem is, for some transcription factors, the binding site is pretty short, and you could find many such sites in the genome, but you know those sites could not all be used by the transcription factor. So there must be some process happening inside the cell that limit the access of a transcription factor to only a certain number of sites. But the first thing to find the mechanism is to first find out where those sites are in vivo. So to that end, we develop a so-called genome-wide location analysis, which basically couple chromatin immunoprecipitation and the DNA microarray. And I would introduce to you the general methodology of that. And then I will go on to describe our recent progress in adopting this method to study human transcription regulators. In a sense, I'm going to talk about using promoter microarrays to study protein-DNA interactions in human cells. I'm going to use c-MYC as a main example to show how this method works and what kind of thing we are learning. Many of you probably are already familiar with the chromatin immunoprecipitation process. So this is a methodology that have been developed to study in vivo protein DNA interactions. The principle behind it is this: you take living cells, you treat them with formaldehyde, a chemical cross-linking agent that will cause the covalent linkage between a protein and the DNA binding site that it's sitting at. The cross-linking happened in very short time, but it's not very efficient. It only captures a certain percentage of protein-DNA interactions because it requires that the protein and DNA has to be very close to each other, and there has to be the right chemical group, lysine and amine group, next to each other, almost next to each other, so that the cross-linking can happen. But as you know, protein DNA come off and on, come on and off all the time. So inside the cell, this chemical cross-linking happens probably only a fraction, only capture a fraction of what DNA protein is binding to. But in any way, since we are starting with a population of cells, we should be able to still capture a significant fraction of the protein DNA interaction, allow us to get a clue of where a protein is binding to in the genome. So in order to identify the binding site, we use a combination of molecular of biochemistry and the DNA microarray approach. So we start with cross-linked cells, sonicate them to fragment the chromatins, isolate the chromatins from inside the cell, and then use an antibody that recognizes specifically the protein, the transcription factor that you are interested in, bring down the protein as well as the DNA that's it's associated with. And then we separate the protein and DNA by protease digestion, and then ligate a common linker to each piece of DNA so that we can use the primer to do a PCR amplification of the entire population. Then, in order to find out where which region of the genome has been brought down, we use a DNA microarray that represents the genomic regions for that organism, and then do this hybridization. So as a control, we also use a input DNA, label it up, that represents equally different regions of the genome. So by comparing these two samples, if a region is enriched, it should show up as a brighter spot in this channel than in the control channel on the DNA microarray. Just to show that point, this is a low resolution of the image of the entire slide, and this is zoomed up. As you can see, majority of the DNA spots show equal intensity between size 3 and size 5 DNA channels. But if there's a binding site, you see a brighter red in the IP, the immunoprecipitated DNA channel. And that can be identified by using statistic analysis for the entire image.
What kind of mutagenic problem do you see
on the DNA microarray? So so the goal is to try to capture which genome of the region, which genomic region being bound by the factor, right? So for yeast, we have been making genomic arrays that covers intergenic from 5' from the stop codon from the first gene to the 5' start codon ATB.
Whole chunk,
yes. Yes, in yeast, this is relatively straightforward to do because the average size of the intergenic region in yeast is less than 1 kilobase. And therefore, you can do, for majority of those genes, you can do, you can amplify them in one shot. For some genes which have larger than average size, we chop them up into smaller fragments and amplify them individually.
What's the typical size of this sonicated DNA fragment?
Okay, sonicated DNA fragment usually depends on how you sonicate. They have a lower limit of 200 to 250, and that's the size of a nucleosome, the unit of chromatins. You cannot sonicate further down then because in vivo, the cell is wrapped into nucleosome, a protein complex, and it can only be that short. But but the upper limit could be several kilobases or even longer. Usually, if you do a consistent job, you could get to 500 base pairs on average.
And the green control is for just break out every piece of DNA randomly.
The green control is the same input as you used for the immunoprecipitation.
But without the.
Without the enrichment part.
I didn't get this technology. Maybe you can explain it a bit slower. What is printed on the chip? What is the aim?
Okay. The aim of this hybridization is to find which genomic region was brought down by immunoprecipitation process, because we did not know which region was bound by the transcription factor. So what we do is, imagine a genome could be 12 million base pairs long, and the protein could bind to hundreds of sites. And to know which sites was bound by that protein inside a cell, we do a cross-linking so that a protein is cross-linked to its binding site. And then we do this physical sonication process to chop the genome into small fragment, 500 base pair in average, and then use immunoprecipitation to select for those sites that are bound by the transcription factor. And this immunoprecipitation process works because you can have specific antibody that only recognize this protein. And the protein is precipitated, and along with it, the DNA that's associated with it. But the immunoprecipitation process is not a perfect process. It's not either you bind, either you select or not. You will have a background of non-specific interaction between the antibody and all the DNA, all the protein. And on top of that background, you can specifically select for certain genomic regions. And those regions, you can identify them because now you have an array that allow you to specifically hybridize the mixture of immunoprecipitated DNA to this array. And if a region is enriched by this process, then that region reflected by the DNA spot should have a higher intensity for that channel.
Could you comment on the differences between the epitope modified binding site and the transcription factor and the other approach of using monoclonals specific for that transcription factor? How much of a change in specificity is there with the epitope modified?
There are not many cases where both has been done side by side. We have done only one case, that is Gal4. So we have done Gal4. We have studied Gal4 binding site, both using polyclonal antibodies against Gal4, and aptotag antibody that recognize the engineered Gal4 protein, and the result is identical. There's very little difference. So we believe, at least in one case, this two approach gave us essentially the same result. And as I said, this is the case. In this case, this was the first example we used to demonstrate this approach actually can yield informative binding site information. And this experiment was done with yeast cells that's being engineered to have an aptotag and the Gal4 gene. The antibody that we used can pull down Gal4 and its binding site specifically, as shown in this axis. And as control, this is unenriched input DNA. So the hybridization result is analyzed by conventional softwares. And the what I plotted here is fluorescent intensity for each spot on two channels. One channel is Cy5 labeled DNA, representing antibody-enriched DNA. So each spot have two population of DNA compete for binding. And the ratio will tell you whether a certain population has been enriched. Do you have a question?
Yeah, it seems it will be more sensitive to use the non-packed cell as a control. So you still use antibody.
That's right. Yes.
Instead of a naked DNA.
Yeah, we actually tried that. The problem is if you don't pull out anything, usually the noise is very high, and this data is not as reliable as if you use just input DNA, which you guarantee you have some population of DNA there as a control, right? So this basically showed that about 30 spots on the array were appear to be bound by Gal4 inside the yeast, while majority of the DNA show equal intensity and therefore appear not to be bound by Gal4 under our experimental conditions. And among the sites that we pull out are the previously known all the previously known Gal4 binding Gal4 target genes. And in addition, we further showed that three of those other genes are behave as a Gal4 target genes in that their expression is controlled by Gal4. This just shows the same result, except that we have now expression analysis to couple with our binding binding data. And this green and blue, this colored diagram represents the binding of Gal4 to its target genes under glucose and galactose conditions. And this green gradient of red color represents the induction for the genes under galactose treatment. Since the methodology was developed, it has been used to map the binding site for essentially all the known yeast transcription regulators in the yeast genome, and the methodology was illustrated here. It's illustrated here because you need an antibody that can pull down specific protein DNA complexes. The way to get around having to raise antibodies for each different transcription factor is to insert an epitope tag into the gene for each transcription regulator. A total of 106 strains were constructed this way individually, and the individual chromatin IP was done to identify promoters bound by each tagged transcription regulator. I use DNA microarray to show what they are. This result was taken from a recent paper from Rick Young's group that described the yeast genetic yeast regulatory network in which they identified using this approach. And this is another representation that only list the 106 gene transcription regulators and how they regulate each other. Each arrow from one end to the other represent a regulator and target relationship, and you can tell that the regulatory circuitry in yeast is a highly interconnected one. And right now, there are two problems. One is, what are the codes between regulator and their targets? And the second is, what's the consequence of this interaction in terms of whole genome-wide network modeling? Do you have a question? The interaction is as is defined by the intergenic region for that gene, upstream of that gene. It usually is from the three prime stop codon from the upstream gene and the five prime star codon of this gene. So it's usually around 1 kilobase.
For divergent genes, you score both genes?
Yes. Yeah, for divergent, that's right.
Do you have an estimate of the reliability of this matrix?
The estimate was provided by Rick in their paper. It's the false positive rate is around 5 to 7%, and the false negative rate is on the order of 40% if you use a 0.01 cutoff. So I'm sure this set of data will provide a foundation for a lot of analysis, especially for computational analysis of protein-DNA interactions. The focus that my lab has is to understand transcription factors in the mammalian cells. And to do that, we need a slightly different approach than that we have done with yeast. The main problem is human cells has a genome that is 200 times larger than the yeast, and it's impossible, practically impossible for us to print the entire human genome onto a single microarray slide. So we have to make a decision to choose which region in the genome to print. We didn't actually think hard to come to this conclusion that we need to print in our first print, first version the proximal promoter regions for each gene. I give you two reasons why this for our rationale. One is that most of the known human gene transcription regulators appear to bind to close to the transcription star site. In fact, a survey of about 700 protein-DNA interactions data in the TransFACT database show that over 80% of those interactions happen within 200 base pair from the transcription initiation site. These are experimental data, not prediction, observation. That's right. That's right, exactly. I was going to say that. That's probably because our ability to clone a gene is limited, and therefore previous study throughout 80s and 90s only focused on proximal promoter regions. So let me show you another piece of evidence that support our conclusion that these promoter regions are important. So this is analysis of recent human mouse genome data. So we compare promoters for 5,400, roughly 504,000 homologous gene pairs between human and yeast genome, human and mouse genome. And I plot the percentage identity for averaged from these 5,000 gene pairs across the promoter regions and down 1,000 base pair into the gene coding region. This is from 5,000 base pair upstream and 1,000 base pair downstream, and this is the transcription star site. So as you can see this curve, the peak identity peaks at transcription star site, as you imagine, as you expected, because they are important function, and slowly, the background is around 20 to 25% identity. And the region close to the transcription star site around here has are significantly higher than the background, indicating that they are under selection pressure, and therefore they have some important function. And that what that function is most likely is related to transcription regulation. I see many questions.
Yeah. The last story I understand, the highest score is downstream of transcription stuff. Is that, do I would think of it sort of a gene specific regulator, or is it driven by general
factors? Well, the previous slides, those happens, well, here, the zero is here. Zero is actually, this is slightly tilted. So zero is here. It's not general transcription factor because it's really only focused on gene specific regulator.
So really the highest piece of
right upstream of the zero, between zero and 100.
How do you know where transcription starts?
It's based on this 5,000 gene pairs, their transcription star site is based on the public annotation in the NC in the gene locus link, and because it's based on experimental evidence. Essentially, what they did was they took the longest 5' region for each gene cDNA and map it to the human genome, and it's for the majority part it's pretty reliable. Especially for the ones that we know their function, as has been studied for many years.
Yeah. How many insertions do you expect between a human and mouse? That is, there could be a little length mismatch. A motif may still be there, but just looking at percentile identity at a certain distance, you might lose it.
Yes. Yes. There are many insertions or deletions when we do this.
May not drop to 25%,
so that's right, exactly. Yeah, so they were averaged out. They were, essentially they came down to the bottom. So there are regions upstream that are important, but it's not reflected by this comparison because they were averaged out.
We know MYC works on the proximal promoters, in the case of no.
I'm sorry.
This
MYC. MYC is gene-specific DNA binding factor. Its binding site has been found in many different places, both upstream and downstream, and even very far upstream.
You claim that you differentiate in general and specific transcription factors.
Yes.
I don't understand how you do that, but this definitely doesn't differentiate between the two. This is just looks at what's conserved and what's not conserved.
No, my point is to understand where a protein is binding to. And I did not try to differentiate between general and the gene-specific regulator. And this graph is try to show the point that is a rationale what we take when we decide to print only the only the promoter regions for the gene rather than the entire gene, which could be hundreds of base kilobase long. And in this, we only focus on the 1 kilobase region of the gene promoter, and that will cut down the cost significantly when making DNA microarrays. I think definitely the other regions of the genome are also important, but is currently beyond reach because of the cost associated. So this is just a general diagram to illustrate how we print and make these microarrays. We start with locus link gene annotations, extract promoter sequences for the 7,600 genes that we are able to get reliable information on. Design oligo primers to amplify each individual promoter and synthesize oligo and do a high throughput large-scale PCR and purify each PCR product and verify their size by electrophoresis gel, and then train the purified DNA onto a glass slide.
Do you take care to avoid any repetitive DNA that might be in that region?
We don't. So when we design this oligos obvious design has taken that into consideration, but whether there's repeat in the intervening between the, within that, we haven't take special attention to that. But that was kind of the noise introduced by repeated DNA is taken care in later step by including a Cod1 DNA in our hybridization condition. The Cod1 DNA being enriched for repetitive DNA sequences and therefore could serve as a code blocker for hybridization to those sequences. So just to show example how well this works, we start with focus on c-MYC. It's an important gene because a number of human cancers have been found where c-MYC gene is translocated and overexpressed in these cancers. And it's playing an important role in the pathogenesis of those cancers. c-MYC belongs to a large family of basic helix loop helix family, which is illustrated here. And c-MYC is a long protein, 450 some base pairs, some amino acids long. Its DNA binding region is around this region, basic helix loop helix, and it also has a leucine zipper. It has two domains, transcription activation domain, that also been mapped by previous studies, and also have a region of repression that it could play in its repressive function. The c-MYC binds to DNA as a heterodimer with another protein called MAX, which is in the same family. The structure of MYC-MAX binding to DNA has just recently been solved by Nair and Burley and published recently. As you can see, this is a typical basic helix loop helix protein, and the basic region and the first helices of the basic helix loop helix serve as a DNA binding surface, while the loop region and the helix loop and the helix region and the leucine zipper serve as the protein dimerization region. From this protein structure, protein DNA structure, there really is very little information as to how MYC and MAX specifically recognize DNA. Previous studies by CLAX experiment have shown that MYC recognize CAC GTG sequence called the EBOX. c-MYC and MAX together binds to this short six base pair region specifically. So the model, through nearly a decade of studies, shows that c-MYC and MAX binds to this region and mainly activate genes involved in proliferation and cell growth. MYC binding to MAX can be competed away by MAD's interaction with MAX, and this together MAD and MAX binds to the same region, same EBOX. Unlike c-MYC, which mostly act as a transcription activator, MAD mainly act as a transcription repressor by recruiting histone deacetyltransferases, the enzyme that cause repressive chromatin structure. So a model that has been proposed by many key groups, including Ron DePinio's group, is that the blockade of this transition between Mi'kmaq and the MADMAX complex is what caused cancer. Because when you have over high levels of Mi'k, those genes that are turned on by Mi'k will drive the cell to proliferation and cell transformation. And that's what caused the cancer.
So how much is known about the flanking sequence of this binding site? Obviously, six bases doesn't give you enough space.
Exactly. There is a tendency for Mi'k and MAX to bind to have a C on this 5' prime end and the G on this end. And there is also another study shows there might be some other base pairs upstream and downstream that could be relevant. But this is the minimum base pair that can confer specificity.
Do these Mi'kmaq tend to have a lot of partners or specifically?
Mi'k and MAX hydrodimerize specifically. But MAX hydrodimerize with MAD proteins, which have 4 or 5 in their family. And Mi'k also have several family members in its own subfamily. Mi'k doesn't dimerize with other with MAD. Mi'k also in vitro it can homodimerize, but it does not appear to be so in vivo. And MAX has been argued to homodimerize in vivo, but also there are reports to say that MAX is phosphorylated in vivo and therefore which prevent its homodimerization or prevent a MAX homodimer to bind the DNA. So what we believe right now is in vivo, if there's Mi'k, abundant Mi'k inside the cell, Mi'k and MAX form heterodimer and regulate their targets. So Mi'kmaq have many different functions, including regulating cell cycle, regulating apoptosis, metabolism, cell adhesion, regulating cell differentiation. These are based on, most of these are based on functional assays, overexpression of Mi'k or in vivo studies. There are really very few evidence to back those claim up or to explain the molecular mechanism of Mi'k regulation. So I view there are three main questions in this field of Mi'k regulatory network. What are the target genes? How are the target genes, target sites recognized in vivo? And what are the mechanism of Mi'k activation or repression? I think this set of questions are also generally important for other transcription regulators. But I'm just using Mi'k as an example.
Do the other two Mi'ks that you had on that slide, do they all recognize about the same?
Yes. Nmi'k also recognize Nmi'k MAX. They are cell type specific. Nmi'k usually is limited to neuronal cell lineages. And it's been also been implicated in human cancer in a childhood brain tumor. Oh, that's another, I don't know that. So our strategy to identify c-Mi'k MAX target genes is illustrated here. Essentially, we take cells which derived from original human tumor that has been cultured many generations, we call cell lines. We grow them up and cross-link them, and then use the chromatin immunofixation to pull down just the Mi'k bond promoters, and then use our promoter array to tell which region was bound by Mi'k inside the cell. This is a control experiment, which we show that if you just compare input DNA versus input DNA labeled differently, you essentially have nothing specifically enriched or outstanding here. This is another control, which shows that if you just use a non-specific antibody and compare the DNA that this antibody pulled down versus input DNA, you see a few spots that appear to be binding to either the non-specific antibody or the beads. But if you use a antibody that specifically recognizes MYC, this is a polyclonal antibody that recognizes the N-terminus, the transcription activation domain of MYC, you pull down hundreds of promoters that appear to be bound specifically by MYC.
What's your set criterion for not being red if it's not lying on one side of the line?
Well, I'll show you just right now. We did that also with MAX, and what's red is the common set between MYC and MAX. So MAX, as we expected, being the other part of the heterodimer, appear to bind essentially the same sets of genes, but plus some more. Yeah, this, right? Yeah, I don't have the slide, but we do, usually we do this experiment in triplicate or even more times, and we average the binding data together to generate a set of genes, a set of target genes that whose averaged p-value is less than 0.01 and fold ratio, fold enrichment could be 2. So if for individual experiment, the chromatin immunofixation efficiency could be lower, and could also, there are individual slight anomalies, and therefore that's why it caused, in this slide, there are spots lying inside the curve, inside the p-value curve. After identifying where MYC and MAX bind to those genes, we next asked, what happened? Are they being actively transcribed? To answer that, we used two antibodies that recognize, we asked whether TF2D complex, which is part of the general transcription machinery, and the polymerase 2 also are localized on the same gene promoters. So the approach is the same. We take those cells, and instead of using MYC or MAX antibody, we use TF2F250 antibody, TF250 antibody, or POL2 antibody. TF250 is the largest subunit of the TF2D complex. It will tell us whether TF2D is binding to those regions. And the result shows that a majority of the c-MYC MAX target genes appear to be bound by both TF2D and POL2 complex, and therefore they appear to be actively transcribed in these cells. Another quarter of the MYC MAX complex target genes appear to be only bound by TF2D, and we don't know whether they are being actively transcribed or not. And another quarter of the target genes appear to be only bound by MYC and MAX and not by TF2D and POL2. I'm just assuming because, this is assumption. Yeah, I could, exactly. This is just another approach to see whether, to say whether a gene is activated or not. But this provides a mechanistic view of whether a gene is being transcribed, because you look at where the machinery is localized. mRNA level give you a static accumulation of messenger RNAs for that gene, but does not necessarily tell you whether that gene are being actively transcribed.
Is it more than that? I mean, in expression, you must differentiate between primary, secondary, tertiary targets.
That's right.
So
yeah.
See whatever goes up. And this singles out primary targets.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But your average genome for a large colony of cells, so suppose in the case where you're both present, couldn't it be that part of the time it's only MYC, part of the time it's only the HODL enzyme, and you just interpret it as them being bound together, but it may not at all be the case?
Yeah, exactly. To address that point, we're going to do a sequential IP experiment to pull down MYC and then do that. We haven't, that experiment is being done right now. So how are these genes promoters activity, how are these MYC target gene promoter activity look like in the different human tissues and cell lines? And can we draw a correlation between their activity and the MYC level? So to address that question, we take the genomic Novartis Foundation data, which surveyed more than 6,000 genes, human genes, expression in 46 human tissues and cell lines. We found 370 of our MYC target genes in this data set. And we clustered their expression, 370 unique genes expression, across these 46 tissues and cell lines. And on the x-axis, it's different genes. And this panel, it's the MYC level, mRNA level, in the corresponding tissues. So as you can see, MYC level is upregulated in these cell lines, lymphoma cell lines, and the tissue here. When you see in this, many of the MYC target genes appear to be highly active in the same cell lines as shown in red color here, and green color represents a downregulation of the same genes in other tissues. A small population of MYC target genes appear to be in a reverse correlation, inverse correlation with MYC level, and they might suggest that MYC gene is being repressed by MYC here. And indeed, one of those genes is a known MYC repressed gene, P27. So just a summary, I've shown you that gene-wide location analysis can be used for studying human transcription regulators, and also shown that MYC-MAX bind to a large number of gene promoters in the human cell, in the Burkitt lymphoma cell. And the majority of the c-MYC target genes appear to be actively transcribed in the Burkitt lymphoma cells, and might suggest that MYC playing a significant role in their activation in those cells. And therefore, those genes provide a candidate list of markers and potentially therapeutic targets for cancer therapies. And the small number of c-MYC target genes appear to be negatively regulated by this protein.
What's the overlap between group of genes that bind c-MYC but not the POL2 and the genes that you got from the Novartis set that appear to be repressed? Those could be potentially similar.
I haven't specifically looked at that data set because we just got this data literally last week. Haven't come down to that point yet. Just by first glance, there appear to be some overlap. For example, P27. P27 is not. The interesting thing about that one is P27 is bound by both MYC and TAF250, and TF2D, but appear to be repressed. So we have no clue on. This might suggest some very interesting mechanism of gene activation or gene repression, but for some reason, that needs to be further pursued by other studies.
Question, what was the reference in this micro experiment? Because could it be that it's just the decrease in activation by MYC that you see as a negative log ratio?
Oh,
it could be that in that tissue.
That's right.
It's
right.
Like the same as repression shows up on
That I haven't addressed that point yet. So it could be true. So we just normalize them this data set for each gene. We basically used average as zero, and it could be that there's just no active repression going on here, right? But at least for one case, the P27 case, it's been shown that it's being actively repressed by c-MYC. And the mechanism is, although not completely understood, involve binding of c-MYC, and it's also another protein called MITS1.
But I think the correlation that you see with the mRNA of MYC mm-hmm. actually argues against the just simple normalization effect, right?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when you, for example, you look at cell cycle gene, because you don't do correct normalization, certain gene turns to be null
uh-huh.
compared to the average value.
Yeah.
The correlation with mRNA actually, I think, is strong evidence. That's not, it's not just simple.
Not just simple normalization. Yeah, that's a good point. So in the remaining several minutes, I'd like to just brought up some questions when we analyze the data set we just got. One obvious question is whether EBOX is responsible for c-MYC binding to those gene promoters. So we look at where EBOX is located in our gene promoter data, and this graph is the frequency distribution of all possible sigmers in the EBOX bond promoters. And on the x-axis is the percentage of motifs containing a particular promoter. And on the y-axis is the frequency of motifs, the number of motifs that fit this criteria. And MYC, for example, the EBOX here, CECGTG, appear to be only represented in 26% of our gene promoters pulled down by this MYC antibody.
Is it MYC and MAX or intersection, or is it just MYC?
MYC and MAX intersection. Yeah, but that accounts for more than 90% of the MYC. CETGTG is another MYC binding motif that was pulled out by the CLEX experiment done many years ago in Bob Eisenman's group. And the message is that CECGTG is not overly predominant in the sets of promoters that we pulled down. Neither is the other motif. So if it's not predominantly abundant, then we ask whether it's highly enriched in the set of promoters we brought down by the antibody. And the answer is no. This is another histone, another frequency distribution for the ratio between motif frequency in c-MYC bond promoters versus a random chosen sets of promoters. And one on the y-axis is the motif frequency for that that fit this particular frequency. EBOX is only slightly overrepresented in the set of MYC bond promoters, only about 20% more than average. And the other MYC binding motif, CETGTG, is on the borderline. It's even less represented than the random sets. So this brought out many questions. The question is, clearly, if you just focus on EBOX and try to predict where MYC binds to in vivo, you are going to miss the majority of the MYC binding promoters. So how do we reconcile our knowledge of protein-DNA interactions? Are there other potential binding sites that MYC could also recognize in vivo and occupied by MYC? or other mechanism that MYC could use to load itself to the gene promoter, for example, through interacting with other proteins. I think those are all important questions remain to be addressed. We are just beginning to realize this is a serious problem. Just a summary of what I talked about. We know that EBOX alone cannot explain the specificity of c-MYC binding to target promoters. We hypothesize that c-MYC binding to gene promoters may involve c-MYC versus non-canonical EBOX interactions, but we need to find out what those interactions are.
What do you mean by non-canonical?
Other than EBOX. We don't know. We cannot foresee what's going to be. We have some candidate that we need to test whether they interact with MYC. C-MYC binding to gene promoters may also involve other mechanisms that, for example, protein-protein interactions may be important. What's next? I think our approach to use to combine chromatin immunoprecipitation with DNA microarray can generate a snapshot of DNA protein interactions inside the cell. And this snapshot could help reveal, first of all, the construction of the architecture of the regulatory network in a particular cell. And it could also help identify the mechanism that govern in vivo DNA binding specificity for particular transcription regulators. But obviously, there are a lot of questions that we could investigate now that try to relate to the mechanism part. Several possibilities include protein-protein interactions or chromatin structure modifications. And we need to design an experiment to test those. Ultimately, we hope that by integrating protein DNA, protein-protein, and mRNA data, we could come up with certain model that, at least to the first degree, could explain transcription regulation in mammalian cells. To acknowledge my coworkers, the MYC experiment was mainly done by Zhi Rong, a postdoc in my lab, and a technician, Sarah Van Kalker, who has been instrumental in the setup and management of our DNA microarray facility. Chen Shi provided a lot of bioinformatic help and analysis. That's it.